you inside the latest stories in sports business and advice from some of the best in the industry. This is BSSF's Sports Business Podcast, presented by the Business of Sports Society at Fordham. Welcome into episode 8 of BSSF Sports Business Podcast. Happy to be back with you this week with Alex Woltz, as always. Another good 2 weeks in sports. A lot, again, so much going on. We had the Masters last week. NFL regular season, we're about halfway through the season now. Things are going pretty good. What do you think about the past few weeks?
You know, I feel like things have kind of tempered down a little bit. Because you remember a few months ago, we were at that stage where it was like, we had so many things going on. You know, the NBA Finals, we had the World Series, we had the NFL, we had everything going on. Now it seems like we're in a bit of a groove again, where it's like we've got a few sports here. It's not overload, you know, sensory overload with the amount of games we have going on, but there's still enough to keep us satisfied. We had the NBA draft the other day. That was good. Talk some basketball again with the stuff going on in the offseason, but NFL rolling on, college football rolling on, and yeah, it feels like we're just back to normal again.
That's definitely true. I think now looking back, it was pretty much sensory overload because it was the World Series, the Stanley Cup Finals, the NBA Finals. It's just so much going on at once. The NFL was back with their regular season. Now it's, like you said, it's just the NFL, college football, maybe like the end of the soccer season here in MLS, and that just kind of things more at a normal pace compared to the, you know, three major sports championships within a month. So definitely a good way to put it. We're out of that sensory overload and probably definitely had an impact on some of the ratings, which we saw. But the big news of the past week was really didn't have to do with sports, which is there are now two proven vaccines that have over 90% effectiveness that are going to be started to roll out and get approved by the FDA and everything. So, I mean, congratulations to the people that worked on so hard on that for the past few months. It's going to really enable us to get back on our feet and start having some of these events like we used to. And that goes right back into sports. And because this is really the first event that had to leave, and it's going to be one of the last to come back. Now, at least with this vaccine, and we have two of them now, I think there's some hope for fans getting into these stadiums sooner rather than later.
Yeah, and if you're an owner, I don't think you could have gotten better news out of this in a sense, because like, and the reason I think it's good to start with this is it's kind of a parallel between what we're seeing in fans and some teams, the NFL, like the Eagles are, you know, rolling back the amount of fans that they're letting in. You know, coronavirus is still raging across the country right now, but at the same time, this news that the vaccine comes out that you bring up, and I think that is kind of, it's like that light at the end of the tunnel where we could start to see, hey, you know, if we can knuckle down here, get through these next few months, which are going to be tough for the NFL as they're tightening protocols, they're really putting the hammer down here and trying to get through it safely. If we can get through that, we can get to the Super Bowl. There's some positives that can come out of it.
Yes, yes. And I know they do plan on having fans at the Super Bowl, as you mentioned. It's going to be in Florida, which has been one of the states that are pretty much still fully open, which is beneficial for the NFL. But I'm starting to think now about NBA and NHL when you're in arenas. In particular, because they're waiting to start their seasons. NBA's come out saying December 22nd is most likely the start date. NHL is still aiming for January 1st. We'll see what happens there. My mind when these vaccines were announced came to those leagues that have to play indoors. We've seen now with the NFL, you're able to spread out outside. It's a little bit easier. College football's been doing it too. My concern went to the indoor sports, and this gives them some hope that hopefully maybe towards the end of their regular season, they can start getting some fans back. It may not be right when they start, but it'll be a little bit later on in the season. Hopefully by the end of the regular season into the playoffs, they'll get some fans in there and start getting some of that ticket revenue back, which is so crucial, as I think has come to light over the past few months, more than people had realized in the past.
And that indoor element, we haven't even charted those waters yet. You know, we have not, seasons ended. The NBA was the first to go when the coronavirus came, and everything that's come back since has been outside, like you mentioned, football and NASCAR and sports of that nature. We haven't really tested an indoor sport yet. And from what we've learned from recent coronavirus studies and things like restaurants and gyms and bars and indoor areas seem to be where this virus spreads the most easily and is thus the most dangerous. And I don't see really a way that the NBA can let fans in, or the NHL for that matter, let fans in at a decent capacity without some sort of security of a vaccine, some sort of security of testing people in advance and things of that nature, because otherwise it seems like it's just too much of a risk and it's not really going to be worth it to just get a few fans in the stands because they couldn't be able to do more than the minimum capacity. So indoor arenas, we have not tested yet. We don't know what's going to happen when we try it. The NBA is going to at some point. They're at the point, I think, where they're going to need to make that decision. And a vaccine is hopefully one of the ways that they're going to be able to do it with confidence that everybody can stay safe in the process.
Right. And something we were going to mention next, and I might as well bring it up right now, which is, the Golden State Warriors and their CEO were trying to propose a plan to the city of San Francisco to, you know, allow 50% capacity into the Chase Center with not even dealing with a vaccine and just focusing solely on rapid testing. Their CEO had talked about, investing over $30 million in rapid testing for all players, employees, fans, anyone that comes into that building on game day, testing every single one of them. And the gentleman is actually an epidemiologist by trade. He's a doctor of infectious diseases and everything. So he actually is not just a businessman. He's someone that is in the medical community. Interestingly enough, and he was talking about how he felt that if you had rapid testing for all fans and all employees, that you could have about 100% capacity. Now, they only proposed a 50% capacity to the city of San Francisco, which was ultimately rejected. But, you know, this is coming from someone, not just a business person. He is a respected doctor at the least. But I think it does kind of show at least reluctance from the government, who really is the one that controls it. I mean, I would say even if the city of San Francisco had approved it, I think the state of California would have most likely rejected it. I think there's this trepidation on the part of the government, the state, city, to allow these events to happen as well. It's not just the teams being cautious, because obviously you don't want a public relations issue or just a general health and safety issue of, you know, there being an outbreak in your arena. But I think it also shows the worry and concern from the governmental side that really is in control of all this.
Joe Lake is a fantastic owner. And I think if there was a guy in the NBA that I would expect to make a proposal like this, he would be the one. And I was not shocked to hear this, but I do think it's a bit interesting to think about the dynamics here, because I'm going to throw something at you and you tell me if you agree with this. I think it's interesting that we can have 25, 50% capacity outdoor events, but we can't have people tested at a 50% at an indoor event. What's the difference there? You know, I think it's an interesting question where certain states and certain counties are allowing fans outdoors, not tested. We've seen it college football. They're on top of each other, and it really doesn't matter to a lot of these states. Granted, they're in different parts of the country. There's a regional element, a political element here that is important, but still, you know, we have outdoor fans that aren't tested, and for all we know, the virus could be spreading there. So we have a situation here now where an NBA team has an innovative plan. They say, we want to make this safe. We're knuckling down, and we have this idea that we feel confident about where we can let fans safely into the arena. And the city says no. And I understand it from the city perspective. I'm somebody who isn't necessarily that excited about the idea of fans, but I think there's going to come a point where coming to a game comes with a certain risk. I think we know that. You and I can both agree that going to a sporting event right now, there's a risk that comes with it. And if you could test people, if you can make that extra element of safety, even if you're inside, that doesn't exist right now. I would much rather go to a game where I'm tested and everyone else is than go to a game that isn't, and the outdoor football games that we're seeing right now. I understand the worry. I understand the caution, and it might be a little soon to jump out and let fans into an indoor arena like that. But I think the Warriors still do deserve some credit for making a plan like this. And there's going to come a point where I think something like this is going to be implemented, because they're going to need revenue. Fans are going to want to come back. And I think this is the only way feasibly to do it with the indoor element that we discussed earlier.
Right. And I think the most important part is they're showing they're willing to make the investment to make it safe. But it also shows on the side of, you know, the government and the city and the state that they really are trying to focus on the vaccine. And that's why I'm saying that, you know, with these two new vaccines, you know, hopefully we can start to, you know, get back in these arenas, because they have been talking, you know, the whole time, you know, try and slow the spread, and then it was, well, we need a vaccine. So now that the vaccine is here, I think that's really the key, is distributing this vaccine, making sure, you know, they have this vaccine. I know Ticketmaster was talking about that you would have to prove that you got the vaccine.
Yeah.
To go to concerts. It didn't mention sports, but it mentioned concerts in particular. Which, could that be something that's implemented in leagues? Could that be something that's implemented? You know, I mean, it's hard. It's really hard, at least from a, you know, personal individual freedom perspective, to force people to get a vaccine. But, you know, that's kind of, I think, the battle that people are in right now, where should we, like, enforce that a vaccine needs to be had to enter the games, or does that impinge too much on personal freedom, or does the health and safety override it? It's such a thin line right now. But I think, you know, just in a more direct sense, the fact that we have vaccines now, they're not distributed yet, but by the time you reach April, May, when the NBA and the NHL are starting to wrap up their regular seasons going into their playoffs, I really hope that there will be fans there at a limited capacity at the least, because of the vaccines, not necessarily that rapid testing. Rapid testing could still be implemented, but I think more so this, the vaccine aspect is what's going to be most crucial for especially the indoor sports to get their fans back.
It's such an interesting conversation, because I think on one hand, the vaccine news is so positive and there's so much good out of it, but also we have to remember the distribution of it's going to take time. You know, and people who are going to these games are probably going to, people like you and I have a younger demographic, maybe aren't the highest risk. They might not be the first in line to get the vaccine. So I think it's a very much a future-oriented plan to say that the vaccine is going to be the key to getting fans in the arenas. That's for sure. When we have vaccines and everybody that comes is vaccine, we're going to have high capacities. We're going to be back to normal. But what are we going to do in the meantime is, I think, the big question. And I don't really see, I agree with you, the NBA, I don't think they can go another playoffs without fans. I think there would be something real dismal about that. And I don't think they want to do that. Will we have a vaccine that everybody, or at least a decent amount of people, will have access to by that time? I really don't know. I think it's a difficult question. And in the meantime, the NBA is going to have to find ways to get initiatives in place to let fans in the arena, at least in some capacity, that they could still feel safe in an indoor environment without the vaccine, because it's going to take time till we get there. And I feel like what the Warriors proposed here is one way of doing it. Like I said, it might be a little too soon. I think, you know, to do it opening day is a little ambitious. I think we have to kind of see how it goes and make sure players and staff are safe first before we let fans in. But after we do that, I think midseason, we're going to start seeing things like this become a bit more of a focus as we really try to figure out ways to get fans, like you mentioned, when it's so important in the playoffs.
Right. Well, I can just say I was very happy to see this vaccine come out, obviously, because of all the, you know, positive implications we'll have, not just on sports, but, you know, hopefully we'll be getting back to some sense of normal life soon, whether that be in the next few months after, you know, it's distributed, because again, that distribution takes time. But, you know, hopefully within the next, you know, 6 months or so, we'll be back to where we were, you know, this time last March, you know, this past March, back when we could go to sporting events without masks and distance and stuff like that. So again, happy to see this vaccine here. Hopefully it'll result in fans getting in stadiums sooner rather than later. Probably, my guess would be around the May time. Hopefully we'll get some fans back inside arenas across the country. So that will cover our discussion on the revelations with the vaccine and COVID-19 and fans. So we're going to transition for a minute into NASCAR, which who finished up their season about a week and a half ago, and they crowned a new champion, younger driver Chase Elliott. But more importantly for us is their end of year report started coming out, and one of the big numbers that came out was there was a $150 million loss in track ticket revenue, which was obviously expected given the circumstances. But they did have, unlike some of the other sports, they did have quite a few fans come in, especially towards the end of the season. So they did have a lot of lost revenue, but they are actually predicting that next season is going to be a turnaround, and they do expect to have a profit. So, I mean, I think that's positive news that they're projecting that. I think that's maybe, you know, being a little over positive, but at the same time, the fact that you're saying you're going to be turning a profit after such a tough season as this, I think that's a really positive sign for that sport. You know, I think the question here was this, you know, crazy season that they put together with, you know, having to make up a lot of races during the week and, you know, allowing fans in later on in the season. And, you know, they had fans at their championship, their last race, you know, a week and a half ago. So would we consider it a success compared to some of the other leagues that have gone about what they did with their return to play plans. And I say yes, without a doubt, because there was only one driver that ever got COVID, Jimmy Johnson, who was only out for one race. None of the pit crews got it. None of the owners got it. None of the people from the league got it. There was only one positive test out of all of those drivers and all of those people involved. And on top of that, they had fans, especially towards the end. They had fans. So compared to some of the other leagues, I have to say NASCAR came out on top.
I couldn't agree more. And I think that the first number you bring up is the most important, obviously, that not very few people outside of Jimmy Johnson or none had the coronavirus. And I think, obviously, this is not a contact sport, so I feel like that was kind of expected in some ways. But still, the fact that they were able to do it in a safe manner shows that there was certain discipline from the players, from the pit crews, from the owners that you mentioned. And I think that's the most important number, and the fact that they were able to prevent an outbreak, made sure that the season was able to happen. And I couldn't agree with you more that I think it is a resounding success, because first off, you know, you completed all the races that were on the schedule, and you completed the Cup Series, and we got to the end. That's the real goal, to get to the finish line and to do it safely. And NASCAR was able to do that. But at the same time, I think you could argue this was also perhaps the most normalcy we saw in a sport, where there was the same races, there was fans in the stands in certain venues. You know, the track experience is a little different, obviously, but still, the calendar was hit, and everything that needed to get done got done in a safe manner. And I think that's the most important thing. And you know, you mentioned a little bit before we got on here about the sponsorship aspect, and I think that's another really important aspect that also enhanced some of the revenue in a time where they lost it from the fans that we see here. So, like, the headline might jump out that they lost revenue from fans, but I think there's a lot more to it than that.
I absolutely agree. And NASCAR is such a sponsorship-heavy sport that, you know, whether that be on the team level or the league level, there are so many partners that are involved in this. And the fact that they were able to have fans in there in some states, doesn't matter what the number was, they were able to implement a lot of their game day partnerships. They were able to implement, obviously, on the cars, there's so many part of the sponsors that are stickered on different cars and stuff. So those were able to be implemented. The TV deals happened, you know, every single race was run. Comparing it to the other sports, the way it's been going, I would say the only league that comes kind of close is the NFL, because they've had some fans in there. They've, you know, obviously some teams in the NFL have not been able to implement a lot of their partnerships, but across the board, I mean, you're talking partnerships, some sort of television revenue and some sort of gate revenue. Obviously it wasn't nearly what it is, but across the board, they kind of made some money on all those runs when a lot of these other leagues and a lot of these other teams didn't. And that, to me, stands out, especially when they come back and say, next year we are looking to turn a profit, because we feel that, you know, with our partners, with, you know, the way we've been running this, that next year we're going to be able to turn a profit. That's impressive to me.
And there wasn't really much of a period of inactivity either. They were the first to stop and the first to start. Like, they were right on top of this from the beginning, NASCAR. And I think another thing too that we have to point out is that the television aspect, you know, sponsorships is so important, and the billboards are still going to be there as the cars are on the track. But even the television aspect, NASCAR, we know, has the most dedicated fans really of any that are out there. And there's been so much competition, and we've had that conversation so much about the NBA taking a hit, the NFL taking a hit, all these sports taking a hit. NASCAR was kind of immune to that, because this is a sport that has such a dedicated fan base, and that television viewership stayed steady and in some cases even increased with certain demographics because of other things that happened throughout the season. So I think NASCAR deserves a lot of credit for keeping their reputation up, which is an important part of this, obviously, but also getting the sponsorship still there, the television was still there, and the season got done. So I think there's really a lot of success from NASCAR, and it's going to be interesting to see what they do next year and if that profit does come. But that forward thinking aspect, I think, is really good to see.
Well, that's a good point. Their TV viewership held steady. Obviously, their big plan for restructuring was to try and gain back some of that viewership that was lost. Only 4 years ago, they had about 8 million viewers average, and, you know, last year was down to 4. So holding at that 4 million number is actually pretty impressive when you see the other leagues. It's obviously not the numbers of the other leagues, but the fact that they were able to hold steady with their viewership numbers is impressive, considering how bad some of the other leagues were with how much their ratings tanked. And, you know, we're going to talk about it even a little bit with the Masters, how their ratings were down It's the same story with a lot of these leagues. All the ratings are down. The fact that these ratings are steady, that's impressive. So all in all, not a bad job from NASCAR, and really definitely one of the more successful sports to handle it. And the last point I want to make is, you know, they said one of the reasons they wanted to come back early was to try and expose potential new fans to the sport. And when it came back, the only two sports that were happening was UFC and NASCAR.
Yeah.
So there was probably more eyes on it than usually would have been. I know mine was one of them. I tried to watch some of those races because it was one of the few sports on television. And, you know, I think their plan of bringing it back early to expose new viewers to it worked. I definitely think it worked. They got new eyes on it, and that'll help them in the long term, even if it's just to hold steady this year or take a smaller loss this year. And hopefully they can build on that next year when, you know, the restructuring that was really supposed to take effect this year. And it did. I spoke with someone from NASCAR yesterday. They were very positive on how the restructuring was going, but really seeing it take effect next year, when they have a full season, fans there for most all the races, different things like that. I think that you'll be able to see it more than some of the gains they made this year that kind of flew under the radar, but will be brought out in the next year through some of the different changes they've made.
Yeah. So, and I think I just want to add one more thing. Like, the standard of success has to kind of change here, because like, we cannot say that this is a failure because of losing revenue from last season. That's just not the right way to look at it. I think you bring up a great point that we're going to see the gains next year. We're going to see, you know, they forged ahead with their restructuring plan. They kept focused and they said, look, losses are going to happen this year. Every league has seen that, and NASCAR is no exception, but the gains of those moves that they made this year are going to be shown in their ability to persevere and have some success moving forward.
Absolutely. I think they did a really great job considering, and, you know, some of the reasons they made headlines this year was because aside from just being one of the few sports with having fans, they kind of modernized some of their practices, beliefs to be more in line with some of the other leagues. I think, you know, there was some positive brand image coming out of NASCAR that hadn't been seen previously. So changing some of their policies and beliefs on things, I think also kind of turned some people's eyes to it. And obviously there was the incident with Bubba Wallace that happened, which obviously proven that it didn't happen, thank goodness. But, you know, just that the way they handled it, they brought the FBI in to investigate this potential hate crime. It ended up proving not, but, you know, the way the drivers, you know, backed him up and unified behind him, I think that's something from NASCAR we hadn't seen and gave a lot of people's respect and attention to. So I think across the board, it was a winning year for NASCAR, despite all of the losses and, you know, things every single sports league is dealing with. So that'll wrap up our analysis discussion on the season NASCAR had. I was going to turn it to college basketball. One of the first times we're talking about college basketball because some big news came out this week, in particular about March Madness. Now, the NCAA has been talking about trying to keep March Madness as much as possible because they lost it last year. That's right as the conference tournaments were going on. That's when everything was canceled from COVID. So having March Madness was the absolute key for NCAA this year. Some people like Rick Pitino, who now coaches Iona, was talking about pushing it to May. You had other people, you know, going back and forth with different ideas. But now what's been decided is they're going to have a giant bubble village setup going on in Indiana and around Indianapolis. I think it's a very smart move, obviously, because you're going to have 68 teams flying in from all over the country. So, I mean, usually the way they do it is, you fly to different cities for the different rounds, and then, you know, you fly to a new city if you move on the following weekend. That's just not feasible during this COVID world. So keeping them all in one location, what better place than Indiana, really the home of college basketball and a state that lives and breathes college basketball. I think it's perfect. You'll have the Final Four at, you know, a Lucas Oil Stadium, big stadium. Maybe they'll even get some fans in there. Who knows? It'll probably be very limited if it's just the Final Four, but who knows? It's a possibility. And I think this is really the best move, especially with the students. You don't necessarily have to worry about the missing classes because all the classes are online. Us at Fordham, where a lot of our classes are online. Alex, I know you've been doing every single one of your classes virtually. Yep. It's very easy to do now through Zoom and other platforms that at least us as college kids, we're used to it at this point. I think those college kids that are the athletes that are going to be playing, they just do the same thing. They just Zoom into all their classes.
Yeah, I think this is definitely feasible, and I do think it will work out. It is surprising to me, though, in this sense, that college basketball in itself with a tournament is almost like bubbles to begin with, where they have, you know, the individual cities for, you know, the rounds and stuff, and gradually they come into one concentrated area for the Final Four. So one of the concerns that we expressed with bubbles in terms of the NFL and college football was the scale of it, you know, how many people were going to be involved. There's got to be scale concerns here, too, with the amount of teams that you're going to have, you know, 68, plus the amount of personnel that comes, you know, you got your trainers and you've got, you know, your coaches and all these different people. There's going to be some questions about the amount of people that are in Indiana for one tournament versus setting up, you know, four individual bubbles like they usually do for college basketball and just locking them down a little bit more than usual. So I'm not going to criticize it. I do think it's the right decision. And I do think there's going to be some intense protocols here because of how important March Madness is going to be, because you brought it up. I mean, losing it last year, that's got to be one of the biggest hits you can possibly take, because March Madness, you know, it's a $1 billion machine. It's college basketball, it's bread and butter. Not having that, certainly once is a big deal, twice is not going to happen. I mean, you and I both know that. And I think they're going to put the right measures in place to make sure it's done safely. And it's going to be an interesting test here of the bubble and the strength of it. You know, college kids, we've seen things that have happened in college football that question, you know, how dedicated they really are to staying safe. But I think the vast majority are, and I do have confidence that this will work out. I think the challenge is going to be getting there, getting through the season and getting all the way to Indiana, because here at Fordham, we can't even start our season because of the coronavirus, you know, our opening night against Iona. So those are where my concerns are more than they are with March Madness.
True. And just to point out, you know, NCAA losing March Madness, that's bigger than them losing the national championship game in college football. It really is. So it's pretty much double, because you have just a much larger TV deal associated with it. Your partners, they have four big partners, you know, investing as much money as they do into the season. Then all of a sudden, the big marquee event of the year outside the national football championship is canceled. So, and they didn't even get to the tournament. It's not even like they started the tournament. They were just starting the conference championships. So I think what'll end up happening is, they said they're focusing on four locations. Probably what they'll do is how they usually break out the bracket, you know, West, East, South, Midwest. They'll put each of those brackets at one of those four locations, and they'll play there throughout the entire tournament, is my guess of what will happen. So that way, at least you can, you know, 16, 16, 16, and 16. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit easier to manage than having, you know, 68 teams in one place. They're trying to spread them out around Indianapolis and kind of the state of Indiana, but the Indianapolis general region. I think that's most likely the plan they're going to go with. And it's the most effective, and I think it's a perfect place for it. And obviously, you're not going to host something like that in New York City, for example, because there's just too many people. I feel like Indianapolis is a good size city to host it. Obviously, it's a great state for college basketball, no place better. So I think just this is a really smart plan by the NCAA, because they know they cannot afford to lose it. And like you said, the goal here is going to be, can we get to Indiana? Can we get there? I think that's going to be really reliant on the teams being strict and the teams putting in their effort to stay safe. And that will eventually, if they do so, you know, all 68 teams will get to the tournament. And then once you get to the tournament, I think it'll be easier to handle.
Yeah. And I think college football's taught us anything. Is I think that the players do have a certain element of safety, because the college football, you think about it, it's a contact sport. You've got so many people involved, and we've seen in general, mostly success. It's starting to get a little bit worse now with the coronavirus. We got a lot of games canceled, but I think most players have taken it very seriously and been very safe in basketball. Now, much smaller teams, much smaller rosters. And, you know, one case might lead to a shutdown like we had at Fordham for a couple of weeks, you know, within the organization. But, you know, as long as there's no outbreaks, I think they will be able to get it done. And the schedules are going to be composed in a way where there will be the opportunity to maybe move some games around, have some buys, and clean some time up, where teams can maybe take those 2 weeks off and we could still stay on track for conference championships and for March Madness. And I don't think it's going to get pushed to May like Coach Pitino thinks, but I think we will get it done in March. And hopefully all goes well and we get a good basketball season here.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're going to have a good season as long as the players do their best to stay safe. And I know it's hard sometimes. It's hard to, you know, even if you're simple as walking into a Starbucks and, you know, the person there has it, you know, realizing that all of a sudden you're infected, you know, things happen. But as long as you try your best, stay safe, you know, I think the season's going to go off. College football is slowly pulling it off. Some teams are doing it better than others. Others have had, you know, games canceled. And one of the things I'm looking to see is what's going to happen if some of those games start getting canceled, because at least in football so far, the Big Ten in particular is the one I'm thinking of, that they have not allowed them to schedule other games. So, for example, Ohio State had their game canceled last week. And it was a big deal because initially when Nebraska had their first game canceled, they tried to set up a game, I believe, with Oklahoma State. I could be wrong. It was a team in Tennessee. I forget which team, but it was a team in Tennessee. And the Big Ten said no. So when it came to Ohio State trying to reschedule a game, they had no choice but to tell them no. And the other team that had missed a game that week was Alabama. Could you even imagine if Ohio State and Alabama both decided on a whim, all right, let's have a game? Could you imagine how huge that game would be?
Yeah.
I mean, 2-3, or well, I guess now Alabama's won, so 1-3. I mean, that just would have been game of the year. That could have been the potential had the Big Ten allowed them to schedule that game. So now shifting back to college basketball, what's going to happen if some of these teams start missing games? Because especially the NCAA tournament is reliant on strength of schedule and wins and like wins in the top 25, all that stuff. What's going to happen if, you know, you have 5, 6, 7 games canceled and, you know, there's a team below you that's played all 20 and has, you know, more wins in the record, but you're a better team. Is that going to start to come into play when choosing these teams in the tournaments? I think that's something to look at for the future too.
Yeah, I think the good thing about basketball is that there's so many games. I think you have a good enough estimate of who's at what position where they can afford to miss a game or two and still have 20 games under their belt. And you could say, I think I know this team is good. This team maybe isn't. And it's a 64 team tournament, you know, 68 versus a 14 college football playoff where we have no idea who's good and who's not.
That's true. Yeah.
But speaking about the Big Ten though, they're the most interesting situation here because their schedule, whereas a lot of teams, one of the benefits of college basketball is that they're starting right after Thanksgiving when kids are off campus and hopefully, you know, the risk of transmission is much lower because it's only athletes on campus. And the Big Ten is doing something very unique where they're starting mid-December versus Thanksgiving and they're playing games on Christmas, which is something that you're shaking your head here. I think it's one of the most interesting things because I understand that you're starting later in December and that you need to push through here, get games done on as many days as possible. But these are college kids playing on Christmas. That is unheard of to me. And I mean, the NBA does it. It's been a great success for the NBA, but those are professional athletes. We're talking about college students now. And in such a difficult year to ask 8 teams to play on Christmas Day, I think that's something.
Yeah, the Big Ten has made plenty of mistakes this year, and you can add this one to the list. I mean, we keep talking about how ratings keep going down. I don't know what they're expecting from Big Ten Christmas Day games when you're going up against major NBA games. I mean, you're going to have, you know, potentially just throw this out, you know, Clippers-Lakers on Christmas Day, and you're telling me that Northwestern Illinois is going to get better ratings? I'm sorry. It's just not. sorry to say it. And I was even mentioning about the Big Ten not allowing, you know, the football teams to reschedule, cancel games, or, you know, find new opponents. That's certainly a mistake. They've had other mistakes earlier this year with the, you know, the lawsuits they dealt with Nebraska to, you know, the way they handled canceling the season, uncanceling the season. It was, you know, they've definitely been taking a lot of heat this year. I feel like you could add this one to the list. I give them credit for trying. You know, they're trying everything they can, maybe turn a little extra revenue, but I don't know how you compete against the NBA on Christmas Day. It's like trying to compete against the NFL on Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
I just don't know how you do it. I feel like this is not going to end well. And then also, you have to remember these are college athletes. I feel that they should be allowed to take off Christmas Day. I mean, I know eventually some of those players are going to be playing in the NBA and they won't be, you know, having Christmas Day off. I get that, but they are still college kids. And especially when you don't have a chance to compete against the NBA on Christmas, it doesn't make sense to me to go that route. I know you have to fit in all the games you can, but doing it on Christmas and competing against the NBA, I feel like this is just not going to end well.
And I feel like if there was fans, this actually could be a decent opportunity, because if you get, you know, wake up on Christmas morning, open some presents, go to a basketball game, celebrate with your family if you're a student, or, you know, I think that could be a lot of fun. I think there's a potential there for people who want to do it to do it. But this just feels like it's going to be just a sad environment on Christmas Day to see empty stadiums. The Big Ten, I don't think they're going to let fans in because they're not doing it for football. I don't think they're going to do it for basketball. To just see these kids playing on Christmas Day with no one there for no real reason other than just adding a little bit of pizzazz to the schedule, I don't think it's the smartest idea. And maybe it works, maybe it doesn't, but I just, a year like this, college athletes, I just don't think it's worth it. And then you got the juggernaut of the NBA on top of it. It's interesting. I mean, we'll see if it works out, but there's going to be a lot of schedule changes, and this is one that I'm with you. I don't think should stay, but is what it is.
Yeah, I don't think this one's going to go over well. I don't know how you compete against the NBA. And then aside from that, even if the Big Ten were allowing fans in, all the students are being sent home by Thanksgiving. There wouldn't be a crowd, even if they let the kids stay on campus for whatever. Maybe get some local families that live in the area, but I don't know how much of a crowd you're drawing for Christmas, especially when the NBA has the stranglehold on Christmas. If anything, people are going to celebrate Christmas in an NBA game, and I don't think there's going to be fans on Christmas Day in the NBA either.
No.
It'll be too soon in the season that they'll be allowing fans in. I just don't think this is going to end well for the Big Ten. But we're going to move on from that. And some news coming out of CBS, something to think about. Jim Nance has his contract up soon with CBS. And he said he's believed to be seeking Tony Romo money. That's what Andrew Marchand has reported out in the New York Post. He's seeking to earn more than $17.5 million. That's what Romo's salary currently is. Nance is currently making $6.5 million, so that is a nice, hefty, more than doubling of your payday, going from probably $6.5 million to $18 million, just say. It's a huge jump, pretty much tripling your entire salary for the year. I don't know if he's going to get it. I mean, to me, he is CBS Sports. He does the Final Four. He does the Masters. He does NFL. He's done, you know, the Super Bowls. I don't know how – I can't picture a CBS without Jim Nance.
Yeah.
I don't think Jim Nance expects to leave either. I think he knows they're going to have to pay up, but – if they can't find the money, then, I mean, you know, ESPN is going to be waiting there with a nice big checkbook, because they have been waiting for years and years to try and find their solid Monday night crew, which, again, this year has been a little bit better, but it has been a bit rocky ever since Mike Tirico left for NBC. You know, ESPN will be waiting on the doorstep, waiting for any opportunity to sign Jim Nance, but I don't see him leaving, and I think he knows the network knows that he's not going to let him leave.
There's a couple interesting things here. I think first off, let's talk about ESPN. Romo was offered around $14 million from ESPN, turned that down to go over to CBS. So it shows CBS is willing to throw the money out there for people that they really do like. But in terms of Romo's contract in particular, a part of Andrew Marchand's article as well was that CBS saw his contract as an aberration and not a benchmark. I think that's an interesting quote to point out, where it's almost like Romo is this exception. We all know him as a color commentator who predicts the plays before they happen. He's got the football IQ. You know, he's valuable to CBS, for certainly. But Jim Nance is equally as valuable. I think a lot of people could say, you know, he does, like you mentioned, does the Masters. He does, you know, obviously the NFL, and he's just all over the place, the face of CBS, as you mentioned. And I think to expect that number to rise to $17.5 million is a steep one, but I also think it's probably worth more than the average $10 million that a lead play-by-play broadcaster makes. I think Jim Nance knows that. I think he knows that what his broadcast partner's making, he's equivalent to it. And I think it's going to be interesting to see what the bidding war comes down to here, because who knows, maybe ESPN will throw some money at him. Maybe someone else will. But I think Jim Nance, he's one of the most talented broadcasters out there. He's incredible. And I think he's right to demand a certain amount of money. And we'll see how it turns out. It's going to be interesting to see how this unfolds.
Absolutely. And he was integral in bringing – Tony Romo to CBS to begin with. He was a big a lobbyer for CBS to make that happen. I obviously had worked with Phil Simms for many years, and you know, it was starting to get a little difficult for Nansen, but they got Romo incredible, and you know, he got a much deserved payday and probably one of the best color broadcasters in football right now, I would say. And I think he's also got one of the best play-by-play broadcasters in football next to him and in Nance. So Jim Nance, to me, is CBS Sports. I don't see him going anywhere. But the potential is there that if there is some dramatic falling out, you know, ESPN and Disney are going to be waiting with open arms with a nice big checkbook for him. Yeah. If CBS decides not to go through with it. But I think CBS will. Like you said, they threw the money at Romo to make sure he stayed. And I think they're going to throw the money at the guy who brought Romo in.
Yeah, and I think the interesting thing, too, that you bring up about Romo really courting Nance courting Romo is that even last week when Nance had a bye to do the Masters, Romo did not call the game instead. He took the bye off and said, stepped away, and, you know, instead of kind of mixing up the partners and kind of stepping away from Nance, you know, there's a link there that they certainly want to keep, and it's been obviously so successful. I've never seen a broadcast duo talked about as much as these guys, just because of, you know, Romo calling the plays and everything that was happening there and the chemistry that they have. And I think that's an interesting element of it. And like, I agree with you. I don't think a breakup's going to happen there because there's too much Nance is too integral to Romo and vice versa. I think there's just too much of a connection there. They wouldn't possibly break it up, but I mean, a 10-year, $180 million contract for Romo, that's a lot for a play-by- or a color commentator. And I think to see Nance get that is a bit unpredictable. I don't think it will happen, but I think Marchand sums it up nicely in saying that a breakup won't really happen, but a showdown certainly will, because Nance has an argument here. He's got a statement that he can make looking at the guy right next to him. And I think there's certainly going to be some merit there for him. And I think it is going to be interesting, and we'll see how it ultimately does turn out. I'm not sure what we're thinking, but we'll see.
Absolutely. I didn't realize that Tony Romo took a bye week with mm-hmm. while Nance was at the Masters. I did not know that. I think that shows you even more how much they value each other, how much they, you know, respect each other, that they don't want to even break them up for one Sunday. And they're not willing to break up for one Sunday. And that Romo is willing to take a bye week so we make sure he works with Nance the entire time. I think that speaks volumes, actually. Mm-hmm. So that's a good point to bring up, too. Speaking of the Masters, they had record lows of television ratings. Seems like the same story. We're beating a dead horse. We say it all the time. Ratings down, ratings down, ratings down. But they were competing against the NFL. I know usually I watch the Masters, and I will say I was watching the Giants in the NFL. So was I watching the Masters? No. And the Masters also ended a little earlier this year, so they could they worked with CBS to do that. So that way the Sunday afternoon, the 4:25 game could start on time and CBS could pick up from the Masters, go right into the NFL game. Even with that, the Masters viewership was down significantly. Some of the worst they've had in their entire days on television, in all their years of television, despite one of the best Masters performances by Dustin Johnson. One of the best in the history of the tournament.
Yeah, I don't know how I agree with you. I don't think this is all that surprising. If you had told me this based on where we were a few months ago talking about the NBA and the NFL, this is not a surprise. It really isn't. But I do think the interesting angle that I tried to say in defense of this was that you have a certain dedicated, you know, conglomerate of golf fans who are going to watch the Masters regardless. But you brought up the point to deny that. And there's a lot of casual fans and a lot of people who are going to watch the NFL instead of when they would usually be watching golf in a typical, you know, Masters season. But this obviously is not a typical one. And I think the thing that screams the most to me about, maybe not the most, but another impact here is obviously the Tiger Woods element, because we remember last year in 2019, he had one of the most improbable wins that you're ever really going to see at the Masters. And I know a lot of eyes, mine included, shifted over there just because of what was going on, because ESPN and everybody loves to talk about Tiger Woods and such a great story and after his comeback. And, you know, you can imagine why so many people tuned in last year and they had record numbers. You obviously weren't going to get that this year, regardless if it was in April, if it was in November, whenever it was. Still, though, I do think it's not necessarily concerning, but I do think it shows that we have a lot of competition right now in sports and we're starting to see which ones people are gravitating towards. And as is always true, it seems like it's still the NFL.
I mean, really, the NFL is the one sport that, yes, they have it took rating hits as well, but they're seeing it the least. You know, they're putting up the best numbers compared to anyone. I mean, every single sport, the NFL, I mean, excuse me, the NBA, the NHL, MLB, you know, you had the US Open, the Triple Crown, all of these sporting events were down to near record lows. It's just the trend right now. And I think initially it was that, you know, what we were saying, that there was just too many sports going on. There's that so much noise, so much buzz from all different sports. Now we're kind of out of that and we're still seeing it. So that's why I was saying, you know, a few episodes ago was, you know, we need to take a hard look at this. You know, why are these ratings so down? Because now we're out of that period where you have the World Series, NBA Finals, Stanley Cup Finals. We're out of that, you know, crazy busy period of all these championships. And these ratings are still down significantly. There has to be an answer to this. We got to figure this out soon as a sports business community, because you know it's concerning that, you know, all of these events are down so significantly. Hopefully next year is, you know, maybe it is a concern about, you know, people are too worried about the virus, or there's other, you know, political news going on. Who knows what it might be that have people's attention away from sports, but maybe 2021 we'll see a rebound from it, just from news settling down, or maybe there is a greater question. Who knows? And I think that's what we need to figure out. And to your point about last year with Tiger Woods, for sure, there was a significant bump on Sunday in 2019 in the Masters, because Tiger had made such a run that they had hit record highs. Because of how of that improbable win last year. So they had a great year last year, and then of course this year they had a record low year. So they've had the best of they've had both worlds these past 2 years.
But I will say
again, it's just another sport that's fallen to the same story as every other league and what they're dealing with.
There is one thing that makes golf a more interesting case study, though, is that looking at the NBA and the NFL as examples, the fan conversation I don't really think applies to golf. I mean, you can tell me if you agree with this, but I just don't go to golf for fans. That's not really where my interest lies with that sport as much as an impact as it has in the NBA or the NFL. And then you talk about the political element. You know, there was a lot of maybe murmur about the NBA maybe getting hit because of their stances on social justice. I don't think golf is really impacted by that either, because it's a very individual sport. It's not an organizational one as much as like something like the NBA. So those two reasons aren't really at play here in a decrease of ratings. So maybe it is just competition. Maybe it is the Tiger effect. I don't know, you know, but it is interesting that I think those two elements that we've been talking about so much with other sports don't really apply as much to golf.
Right. No, you're right. There was no, you know, significant political movement from golf, or in particular, the Masters tournament, the people running the Masters tournament. I mean, they had their worst ratings since the 50s.
Yeah, that's
pre-Arnold Palmer days. Like that's telling, especially when there was no, like you said, the fans. I mean, you could definitely notice that there were no fans around the course. I mean, sure. It's such an iconic course that you would notice the fans were there. Even Tiger Woods mentioned that, you know, the energy just wasn't there, obviously. But did that have that big of an impact on it? I don't know. Golf, I don't think, you know, they, like you said, they don't have to deal with those elements. So who knows, but it's just, you know, another sporting event to add to the list that have seen record lows this year. But we will wrap it up with some Olympic news. The IOC president has come out saying that he is very confident fans will be at the Tokyo Games next summer. So not sure how they're going to organize it. They haven't really said how they're going to organize it, but they're saying fans will be there. And obviously the news of the vaccine coming out, and that's really just more of in the United States that these vaccine news has an impact on. It's not really international yet. I know, you know, the vaccine is really going to be distributed around the US first before it's shipped overseas. They've made enough for the US citizens, but not necessarily enough for, you know, foreign countries at this point. And these are just US companies that have come up with vaccines, not any other countries really. So I'm not sure how they're going to pull this off, because you have so many fans coming from around the world. There was expected that, you know, almost 600,000 people globally were planning to visit this summer when it was supposed to take place. Should be, I'm really fascinated to see how they're going to pull this off. Obviously, I'm rooting for fans being at the Olympics. It's the biggest marquee international event behind the World Cup that happens every 4 years, especially the Summer Games in particular being the biggest event in the world of sports. My guess is that they're going to be focusing on allowing Japanese fans to attend the games, since, you know, they're in the country. It's not like you're flying in from foreign countries. All the fans are there. I think it's mainly going to be Japanese fans. I think that makes the most sense. If they do allow international fans, it's going to be a big, big undertaking.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? And I don't really know necessarily what to expect out of this, because I think they're not saying necessarily that they're going to require people to get vaccinated, because as you talked about earlier, that's just something that cannot happen because of the political element, the personal nature. They can't do that. But I think they're going to make a strong push to get at least all the athletes vaccinated and all potentially visitors as well. And I think if they do that, I think there's a chance this can go off and it can go off safely. But like you said, they cannot force that. And there's going to be a lot of people that want to go that aren't going to get vaccinated, or simply might not have the availability to. You know, like I mentioned earlier, the distribution of it is still questionable. And like you mentioned, we're talking about American vaccines here on a global event. So what's the situation there? I really don't know. So that element of it, I think, is interesting to consider. But I do feel like the Olympics are going to try to get some fans in. We haven't really walked the line of international events yet, so it's a bit questionable, I think, to see how this is going to turn out. But to do the whole entire tournament, you know, the weeks long that it takes without a single fan, I think is just unexpected. I don't think that's going to happen. And if they feel confident that they can do this in a safe manner, and, you know, Japan right now is dealing with some COVID troubles in some of the host cities, and they're confident that they're able to overcome it, that they're going to put the initiatives in place, whether that's a vaccine, whether that's masking, whether that's distancing, whatever it is, they think they can get it done. And if that includes getting spectators, of course, from Japan, I think is certainly likely, but who knows, maybe they'll even target international fans as well. I think it's going to be interesting to watch how this unfolds. And we'll know more over the next few months.
Mm-hmm. It'll definitely be easier to make sure the athletes and the coaches, you know, whether that means quarantine, vaccine, rapid test, they're going to have that for the athletes and the coaches and the teams. That's not going to be an issue. And they can also, you know, kind of quarantine, isolate them because they have the Olympic Village. You can make sure the teams stay in their buildings more often and, you know, not allow them to mingle with other, you know, teams from other countries, different things like that. They're going to be able to handle, like, being able to control the athletes and the coaches and make sure they're safe. To me, the fans is a whole nother animal, because you can rapid test fans when they enter arenas and stuff like that, but I think that's going to have to be more governmental in my eyes, because you're going to have fans traveling in from around the world. So maybe it's something where you rapid test people coming off of planes, you know, after they go through customs or something like that, because I don't think that's something the IOC can do on their own. That's like true. They can control maybe rapid tests before fans enter an arena. But when you're talking about fans from around the world, I mean, think about what we talk about here in the United States, just among states. You know, going from state to state and our own state quarantines, now you're talking about the entire world. So it's a whole nother animal. I think this is something that the Japanese government is going to have to definitely help out with if they plan on having fans. This has to be a whole coordinated effort from the IOC, from the Japanese government, the city of Tokyo. All this is going to have to be worked out over the next few months if they want to make this work. It's going to have to include a significant amount of testing, both incoming to the country before entering arena, stuff like that, and maybe even a vaccine. I don't know. Question is, I don't think there's going to be a vaccine distributed around the world in time for next July. So it'll probably be significant testing, both by, you know, the Japanese government and the IOC in their buildings and their facilities.
The one thing I will say before we end here is that I think that importance that you mentioned of just cooperation and being on the same page, if there's anything we've learned from these last few months, is that the leagues that do that tend to have success. I think the NBA did that, the NHL did that, NASCAR did that. Now the IOC and Prime Minister of Japan, were on the same page as well. And they had that commitment to making these games happen and to doing it potentially with fans. And I think if they have that same ideal and the same drive to make it happen, I think it will. The problems start happening with things like college football when, you know, it's a little all over the place in the NFL. But when we're on the same page, I think the safety measures can be put in place to make sure it happens. And got a few months here to figure it out. And I think you and I are both looking forward to see how it goes.
Yeah. So we'll wrap it up with that. Last thing is a game of the week. A lot of football this weekend again. I think this Sunday night matchup is going to be really great. Kansas City and the Las Vegas Raiders. Kansas City lost to the Raiders at home earlier in the season. That was their only loss. Vegas has is 6-3 record. They can pull within one game of the Chiefs if they win this weekend. It'll be fun. I think this is going to be a fun matchup. First Sunday night game in Las Vegas. Should be a real fun matchup this week.
Well, so the one thing, the last time you and I spoke was the Sunday night game with the Bucks and Saints that we thought was going to be a good one. We were a little wrong there. So let's hope that we don't have another one. Let's hope we don't have another one of those. But I'm going to go to college football because I think I'm a college football fan, number one. But Ohio State-Indiana is a really interesting game to me, primarily because I think the spread is a little too favorable for Ohio State. 20.5 is
fully agree.
Very ambitious. I'm not saying Indiana is going to win the game, but they're a tough defensive team. I think they'll put up a fight, and I do think this will be close. I'm not calling the upset. I think Ohio State's a playoff team, but keep your eyes on this one. I think it's going to be a good game.
I fully agree. If I hadn't said the Kansas City-Las Vegas game, that was the next game I was going to say, which is Indiana-Ohio State. People are underestimating Indiana too much. They've beaten ranked top 10 ranked Penn State and top 25 ranked Michigan. Obviously, they've both fallen out of the rankings significantly since the season started. However, they have earned impressive wins and now are in the top 10. A 20-point spread against a fellow top 10 team, I think that's way too favorable to Ohio State. Not necessarily calling the upset here, but I personally think it's going to be within a touchdown of 10 points. I think it's going to be under 10 spread. Under 20 spread is, I think, way over the top. It's way too generous to Ohio State. They're going to get all they can handle with Indiana. This is going to be one of their toughest matchup of the year outside the playoff. I feel Indiana is very underrated, even being ranked 9th in the country. So that'll wrap it up for us. Episode 8 of the BSSF Sports Business Podcast. Thanks for joining us again and hope you have a great week. Make sure to follow us on Instagram at Fordham Sports Biz and our new website, www.bssfordham.org. We'll see you next week.